I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. After weeks of shows about impeachment, presidential debates, the climate crisis, the coronavirus, Russian meddling, it's time for some comfort food. And we have just the guest, Sam Sifton, the New York Times food editor. His new mouth-watering cookbook, See You on Sunday, is about dinners that began many years ago when he was living in Brooklyn cooking big vats of pasta and platters of ribs for family and friends. Sifton writes, "We cooked on roofs, in yards, in kitchens small and dingy, large and luxe, and beneath fluorescence in a narrow Brooklyn Parish Hall galley to feed groups of 20, 30, more." That began a tradition of community and connection built around a shared meal on Sundays. Sam Sifton joins us from the NPR studios in New York to talk about the importance of fellowship and ritual and the joys of cooking simple, tasty meals for the people in your life. And Sam Sifton, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you.
So what's for supper this Sunday at your house?
Well, you know, this is one of these times when I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to do. I'm out here pitching my book, and all I want to do is get back to the kitchen and cook. And, you know, is that going to be something exotic and giant? No, probably not. I think I'll probably end up with a roast chicken. Nothing beats a roast chicken for a Sunday supper.
This tradition goes back, sounds like many years, to when your kids were young, you were living in Greenpoint or Williamsburg in the Brooklyn section of New York. Tell us about how this all got started.
Well, I enjoy cooking Thanksgiving more than perhaps any other meal on earth, and I ended up writing a book about Thanksgiving. Uh-huh. That fellowship of having friends and family around me is something that I wanted to bring into my life on a kind of daily and weekly basis. So these meals came out of that, a kind of weekly Thanksgiving, a weekly gathering, not just of family, but of the people in my friend group, in my neighborhood, who I could bring together and feed just as I would in November.
It also sounds like this parish galley that you write about was also important. This was a church where you helped to cook meals for people and the kind of ritual that came with that.
It was enormously important. Transferring these meals from simply being friends and family to friends, family, and strangers changed everything for me personally, and I think for my family as well. The opportunity to literally serve others in a kind of ritualistic manner, in a place that sees the kind of beating heart of its practice in the sacrament was exciting. And my kids thrilled to it eventually.
Right.
And it became part of the Sunday supper tradition.
In fact, you're right. Your oldest child said, and this was, there was church and then there was dinner. And your oldest child said to you, "Well, church ought to just be dinner."
Right. And I think that's true, right? Out of the mouths of babes. I learned a lot that day. That really what we were doing was celebrating the sacrament of the meal. Never mind the Eucharist. And by the way, this is not a religious book. This is not – maybe it's a spiritual book? Nah. It's probably just a ritualistic book, and it makes the argument that to share food and drink is to experience something of the divine.
How many people generally show up at your house then on Sundays?
Well, it's not always Sundays, I should point out. What matters is regularity, right? So I like a Sunday because most people have work or school on a Monday and no one's going to come to rage and party. This isn't a dinner party. This is something that happens regularly enough that people can count on it. And so Sunday nights work, but they may not work for you. A Thursday night might be better, or a Monday night, or a Saturday or a Friday. Look at the Shabbat dinner tradition,
sure,
which is an awesome one. We've got the nuclear family, but then we've got the neighbors. We've got the chosen family. I think that's a term of art that perhaps is part of the Gen X lexicon at this point. I think it's interesting that we have kind of intentional families that see friends. So it could be 8, could be 10, could be 6. It doesn't matter. Everybody's welcome.
We're going to play a song that references that in just a couple of minutes. But you mentioned dinner party, and this is not a dinner party. And that got me thinking that dinner parties are generally adults getting together over a meal, whereas what you're really talking about is family.
Yeah. I mean, think of what is said at a dinner party when you answer the door. You say, oh, it's so great to see you. Thank you for coming. Oh, these flowers are beautiful. Oh, you didn't need to bring wine. Put it in the kitchen. Let me take your coat. That kind of hospitality, which is wonderful, and I think you should enjoy it as often as you can, is not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is something that has happened 3, 4, 5, 6 times before, where the person bursts through the door like that Seinfeld character and is throws his coat in the closet because he knows that's exactly where it goes, and then does what he always does, which is what? Set the table, wipe down the counters, immediately do the dishes that are there. It's much more familial and familiar than a dinner party ever could be.
I'm going to quote you again. You write, regularity matters. Standing dinner dates at their best are simply special occasions that are not at all extraordinary. They become that way over time. And it got me thinking when my in-laws were alive and we used to go over on Sundays, mostly have bagels and cream cheese and whatever. But that was a Sunday ritual, and we all were able to gather there because in part we all lived sort of close to each other. And now everything seems so spread out.
Yeah, and we see that in the stress of Thanksgiving, right? Everybody's traveling. It's the biggest travel day of the year. People are freaking out. Will the turkey be done? Do I have enough? Is Uncle Morty going to go crazy with the politics again? And none of that stuff applies here. These are, as I say, as you quoted me, standing dinner dates. They aren't extraordinary. They just happen. And it's only kind of in the rearview mirror that we can see how important they were/are to ourselves and to those around us.
The book is filled with various kinds of recipes, and I have to say, you don't need obscure ingredients for them, which I truly appreciate. What was the process of gathering these recipes for this book?
Well, in my day job at the New York Times, I spend a lot of time with a lot of recipes. We have close to 20,000 recipes now in our database, and we're constantly developing new ones. I love that process. I love the process of reporting out new recipes for readers of the Times. But for this book, I wanted to kind of look back over what amounts to really a couple decades of cooking for friends, for family, for strangers, and see the simplest, most delicious versions of recipes through to publication. I didn't want this to be a project book. I wanted it to be an accessible one, something that could help people make their lives and the lives of those around them a little bit better just by frying some chicken or making some gumbo.
And I do want to get to chicken and gumbo. You also talk about what the sort of basics of what a kitchen should have. And I'm thinking about some people have, luxurious large kitchens, but for many people, space is a premium. What are some of the basic things that every kitchen should have?
Well, this is such a good question because the truth of the matter is most people have most of what they need already, even in that tiny little first apartment kitchen. You don't need all the stuff that's in that luxe, fancy, suburban kitchen. It's great to have, but you don't need it. What you do need is a cutting board. You do need, at least if you're going to cook my food, a Dutch oven or other heavy-bottomed pot with a nice heavy lid on it. You should have a sauté pan. You should have a chef's knife. You should have a bread knife. You should have a colander. And you should have a bunch of sheet pans. These are the secret weapons of the Sunday supper game, those low-rise sheet pans. My friend Melissa Clark at the New York Times always tells me, if you have one, you need two. If you have two, you need three. They come in handy for every possible use in the kitchen, from, of course, their use in the oven as a thing to put food on and roast, but also to carry things around in the kitchen or move things around in the kitchen. I put scraps on mine when I'm cutting and peeling, and then it makes cleanup easier. The sheet pan is your closest friend in preparing a Sunday supper.
You have mentioned chicken, and one of the things you write about in here, and I think it does get confusing sometimes when you look at labels, and there's natural and there's free range. You say USDA organic label, that's the chicken to buy.
Well, it's the only label that actually means anything. Everything else is marketing. I was in the market the other day looking to get a small bird to roast. This was not for a big meal, but just for the family. And I realized that there were like four different chickens available to me, ranging in price from about $6 to $26. And I looked at the labels, and I looked at that $6 bird was bright yellow and plastic and really scary and probably filled with all kinds of hormones I didn't want to deal with. Well, actually, not hormones, but antibiotics I didn't want to deal with. And the $26 one had clearly gone to a good college. And knew its
well
poetry.
Well-raised chicken, yes.
Absolutely. A super educated chicken. But it had all kinds of words attached to it that meant nothing legally. You know, I don't know how much time it spent in free range pasture, blah, blah, blah. What I did know on that sort of middle of the road bird, which was like $19, was that it was raised organically according to USDA regulations, and that's you can check that. That's a fact checkable statement on a bird, and that is where we should start when we are buying chickens from farmers we've never met.
And do these USDA organic labeled chickens, do they taste better than the super college educated one that's so expensive?
You know, it's interesting. I like those college-educated birds. They can be quite good. They can also be, you know, this is an interesting thing that we have become accustomed as Americans to the taste of chicken that is in that middle ground, in that sort of just plain Jane USDA organic. When you get up to the fancier birds that really truly do live outside and run around all day, they're strong, they're muscly, they're not fat and slack. And using them, you need to be aware of that, right? So one of those super fancy chickens is a great thing in a stew or in a long braise. But if you were to fry it, say, a quick cooking method, you might think it tough. And it is tough, but it's also delicious and does best in the bottom of my Dutch oven.
Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Sam Sifton, he's the food editor for the New York Times. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Magazine, founding editor of NYT Cooking, and he's got a new book called See You on Sunday. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too. Here's cacciatore, Dory. Taste of bologna, Tony. Everybody eats when they come to my house. I fix your favorite dishes, hoping this good food fills ya. Work my hands to the bone in the kitchen alone. You better eat if it kills ya. Pass me a pancake mandrake. Having a derby irby. Look in the fendel mendel. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Cab Calloway and his orchestra, the 1947 song Everybody Eats When It Comes to My House. Again, Sam Sifton is our guest, food editor of the New York Times. He's a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He also was chief restaurant critic for the New York Times, and he's got a new book we're talking about called See You on Sunday. It's about the rituals that he has created for the people in his life, these meal rituals also, including many simple, tasty recipes. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499 to share some of the meal rituals in your life and also any simple recipes as well. Let me read a couple of comments. One from Roche: my house is on a frittata kick. Chop up and saute all the veggies that have been ignored during the week. Whip up some eggs and bake together. Andy says, I love Sam's recipes and writing, and I've been a fan for years. Sam, we were talking about chicken, and you do include in this book, and because we're near Delaware, Delaware fried chicken. Where did that recipe come from?
So it's interesting. That's not actually a Delawarean fried chicken. It's Delaware fried chicken because I learned how to make it, or I developed that recipe in Delaware on Rehoboth Beach, cooking for two grand dames of Rehoboth who knew a lot about fried chicken. I was just a kid, and I was taking a pretty good cook at that point, and I was taking a flyer on the whole thing, and I was like, I'm down here on the Delmarva Peninsula. What am I going to do? Everything has Old Bay with these crabs. I'm going to mix in some Old Bay into this flour to season it, and then I'm going to fry, and we're going to see how this goes. This is not a kind of marinated or brined chicken at all. This was straight good old Delaware chicken with a good seasoning on it. And boy, howdy, did it work out. They were over the moon. The secrets to it are the Old Bay to season the flour. And then I was cooking then and now with canola oil or with a kind of neutral oil. And then I flavored it with some bacon. I put a strip of bacon or two strips of bacon into the oil while it heats up, and it fries, and all that fat renders into the oil. And then you're closer than you might be to cooking with lard in the old ways than you would be otherwise. It adds a perfect hint of smokiness, I think, to the chicken.
So as a kid, when did you get interested in cooking?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York City, which is an amazing place to grow up if you're interested in food, because there are 17,000 restaurants or what have you, and you can wander around and compare every slice of pizza in the city, and that'll be a life's work. So food was always around me, and I was interested in it. My mother and father were both very good cooks, and because they were hardworking professionals of the 70s and 80s, we mostly were able to have big meals together as a family on the weekends. And so the process of putting those together was part of my childhood and got me interested in cooking. Later in college, the prospect of working in restaurants reared its head. I had a friend who was a bartender in a local fancy restaurant, and I got a job in there.
Wow.
And the combination of adrenaline and cash was just intoxicating.
Were you a bartender? Were you a server? Were you working in
the
kitchen?
No, I started as a cashier. And in those days, the cashier also pulled the coffee drinks. He was not, or she was not, known as a barista, but as the cashier. And in doing that, I served a lot of quadruple shot coffee drinks to the kitchen staff. And they seemed to be having a lot more fun than I was having. So I asked the chef if I could move into the kitchen, and he gave me a prep cook job, and I Wow. worked my way up through the stations to being a line cook while going to school during the day. And it was great. It was great. Money, waitresses, food. Oh, the best.
Well, I was a waitress through college. That's one of the ways that I was able to pay my way through college, by waitressing. And I do remember that it was sort of an upstairs, downstairs world. When you would go into the kitchen, it was often louder than what was going on in the restaurant, often more chaotic. There was a lot of drama in the kitchen that, you know, when the doors swung closed, hopefully the diners were not hearing that or experiencing that.
That's absolutely true. A lot of adrenaline coursing through the bodies of the people on the stations. And it is true that some of them took out their emotions on the floor staff. But at the end of the, you know, you also must remember at the end of shift what that was like when the upstairs and downstairs sort of came together for a shift drink at the end. And I don't think it's an accident that I ended up in newspapers, because there's a sort of similar rush toward deadline, adrenalized fever that is quite intoxicating still.
I learned be nice to the cook.
I learned be nice to the busboy.
Exactly. Again, Sam Sifton is our guest, food editor of the New York Times, and we've been talking about his new book, See You on Sunday, filled with recipes about meals that you can make that are tasty, rather simple, and about creating rituals around meals as well, that Thanksgiving, that family ritual doesn't have to just be in November. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. You do write about when a grill incinerated a meal, and frankly, I did that. We were having some people over for dinner. In fact, two of the gentlemen had a restaurant in New York many, many years ago, and I thought, oh, I will impress them. And I turned my back on the grill, and I literally incinerated the entire meal. I think we opened a can of tuna fish and made that our meal. But, you know, we've all done this, right? We've burned things to a crisp. And what do you do next, right?
Well, I tipped those birds. It was a grill new to me. It was an old grill, but a grill new to me. And it's clearly operator error, but when I went out there, I had two bricks that used to be chickens, two black smoldering bricks. And I just tipped them into the trash. I had tons of vegetables. It was the height of the summer season, and I had a lot of beautiful, beautiful vegetables from the farms down the road, and I just grilled those simply with olive oil, salt, pepper. I think I might have put some feta on top of them, a lot of lemon juice, and that was our meal. And no one remarked on the fact that there wasn't a giant protein at the center of the table, and I took a valuable lesson away from that experience.
Well, vegetables are more front and center than they used to be.
As they ought to be, for reasons of personal health, for reasons of the planet's health, and for reasons of the nation's health. I mean, if we've got this rising tide of obesity, we're not simply going to counter it by saying you can't drink sugary soft drinks. We're also going to have to change the food we put into our bodies. And having that be more plant-focused is going to help.
Do you have a favorite vegetable recipe?
Do I have a favorite child? I'll tell you what I do. I'm loving right now is eggplant in all its forms, and grilling an eggplant and getting extra smokiness on top of that already smoky eggplant flavor is just bonkers for me. I can fry it, I can bake it, I can saute it. Oh, I think I'm going to have a fried eggplant sandwich for lunch.
Oh, that sounds really good. And there's a certain kind of eggplant that you like. I forget the name of it, but it's very small.
Oh, I like those
little.
I like those little Japanese ones that are not the giant bulbous ones that you see in the supermarket all the time, but the smaller ones, sometimes quite pale with striations on them. Those are really delicious.
You also have a chapter on just cooking in one big pot, and I think someone told you just throw stuff in a pot and cook it and see what happens. Something.
Yeah, that was a priest too, and he didn't say stuff. it's really interesting to see these stews, these gumbos, these bogs, these kind of rich, fragrant pots of bubbling stuff are perfect for this application, because I've been saying all along, welcome the stranger. There might be somebody else. Somebody might bring a new boyfriend or girlfriend. There might be a friend from down the block. I paint this beautiful picture of my childhood in New York, but the fact of the matter was mine was not the house where everybody came, right, after school. There were other people's homes to where I went, and
kind of marveled at the fact that there was always an extra plate available for people. And I wanted that to be our life, our family's life, when I got to be an adult. And now that's the case. And if that's the case, you better have a lot of stuff in a pot, because you never know that, you know, that kid from around the corner is probably going to show up again, and you better feed him.
Let me get John from, it looks like Devon, to join our conversation. And John, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there, John.
Good. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. I happened to catch the last maybe 10 minutes of the program, and I thought it was very interesting. And I wanted to say that my wife and I have a home in Calabria, Italy.
Oh, wow.
In a hill town, and we're never there for more than a few weeks at a time, unfortunately. But when we are, probably the most special thing that we do is have meals with our friends. And as I was telling the person who answered the phone, that in a lot of cases we have to have one meal with a group of friends, and then we rush over to another house so we can have a meal with another group of friends, because everyone feels slighted if we don't spend time with them. But it's amazing, and I think the interesting thing is, and it's an extremely poor area of Italy, that when you're invited over, you're just eating what everyone else eats. As a matter of fact, they're not even making anything extra. You are sharing what they have. So everyone that was originally going to be there, they're just going to eat a little bit less to make sure that you can have some of their food.
Oh, John, that's a great story. Let me give Sam Sifton a chance to respond to that. And I mean, it sounds like what your philosophy, in a sense.
It absolutely is. Although, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I'm so obviously American. I'm like, just make more food. There's plenty for everyone. I do love the idea. I think your listeners may be familiar with the term family holdback, you know, where it's like I always, and my wife and I are always in quiet communication via our eyes. as the level of the pot goes down and we serve ourselves last. And sometimes, yes, our portions are a little smaller than usual, but that's so that we can serve others.
But it seems like you're talking about bringing back something that maybe just happened naturally when families were close together or lived in the same village, as John was describing.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. And if you think about, even in American culture, if you think about immigrant communities bonded together and living in a particular neighborhood and then going to the grandmother's house or to the matriarch's house on Sunday after church or on Friday night for Shabbat dinner or whenever the clan gathered for some kind of feast, we lose that a little bit as we move out and around the country. But then think about our intentional families, the groups of people in our buildings, in our neighborhoods, in our cul-de-sacs with whom we bond. Well, let's feed each other. Bringing ourselves together, not in front of a screen, not to watch a game, but simply to consume food and drink and talk of the affairs of the day, that's a good thing for all involved.
You talk about the importance of setting the table. Help us understand why that is an important part of this ritual.
Well, you've heard me use the word intentional in regards to friends. I think it's also in regards to the meal itself. I said that this wasn't a dinner party. I said that it resembles Thanksgiving in some ways. The place that meets is at the table. And I think that the idea that you're setting out a napkin, that you're setting out a plate, nothing has to match. It doesn't have to be fancy. You don't need to be rich to do this. You just need to signal to yourself and others that I have prepared this table for this sacrament to happen. It's not casual. It's intentional and it's ritualistic. And you don't need to talk about any of that. You just have to do it, because it signals to the people who are there always that this is a special meal, unlike others. It's not like the one where there's a plastic bottle of Welch's in the middle and everybody's grabbing at the slices of pizza before they go watch TV. This is about an actual meal that is there for a reason and there for a purpose. And that's why there's a napkin, and that's why there's a little tea light, and that's why there's a knife that is facing toward you and not your friend.
Oh,
and
okay.
Everything's
proper. Okay. I didn't realize how proper and important that was.
It is important, not for any reason that I can – or it's not for a Miss Manners reason. It's for a reason of intentionality that I think signals to everyone at the table that this meal is different from other meals.
We're almost on a break here. Just one more thing that you suggest, which is to warm the plates. And I've always read about that. I always forget to do it.
Yeah, we all do.
And it's just because it keeps the heat in the cooked food longer? Is that the reason?
Yeah. I mean, listen, you're cooking for a bunch of people. Chances are the food is not going to be, unless it's in this big pot where it's hot off the stove, the chances are the food's not quite as hot as you want it to be. Maybe it's just fine. But if it goes onto a cold plate, the plate is going to leach that temperature right out of the food right away. And you have a better chance of enjoying the hot food if the plate itself is warm. And it's not that hard to keep those plates warm, even in, you know, a chilly northeastern winter.
Huh. Well, we are talking about ritual meals with our guest, Sam Sifton. He's food editor of the New York Times. He's also a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's got a new cookbook called See You on Sunday, and he's founding editor of the New York Times cooking website. And he was a restaurant critic, or I should say the chief restaurant critic for the Times as well. Spent some time working in a kitchen as a younger person. You can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowing, talking with Sam Sifton about ritual meals not eaten in front of the TV set. Here's a scene from The Simpsons. We always like to play The Simpsons clips when we can. Marge is frustrated that the family habitually eats in front of the TV.
Is it really necessary to watch TV while we're eating? We're getting food all over.
If you really wanted us to be neater, you'd serve us out of one long bowl.
You're talking about a trough. We're not going to eat from a trough. And another thing, it's only 5:15. Why are you in your underwear?
Hey, this ain't the Ritz.
At least let's have a civilized conversation, shall we? Lisa, how was school?
How was what? What?
School.
It's not time for school.
I know it's not. I'm going into the dining room to have a conversation. Anyone who wants to join me is welcome. Hello, Marge. How's the family? I don't want to talk about it. Mind your own business.
Keep it down in there, everybody.
Oh, I love The Simpsons. And I think we can all, Sam Sifton, we can all relate to Marge.
Absolutely.
That TV set, right?
Yep. Yep. No place for it in a Sunday supper. I mean, look, I'm an American. I love television.
Sure.
But I think we can gather without it for this one meal. And I think that if we do that over and over again, after a couple of months, everyone realizes how great it is and looks forward to it, even if they're grumbling like Homer.
Exactly. Here's an email from Richard. What about the practical realities of work, two-income families, kids' schedules, et cetera? And I think Richard is speaking to the fact that everyone just feels so harried and, you know, they just don't want to do one more thing.
Yep. I think that I sympathize with that 100%. But I also recognize that there are tons of people who have figured out some way to take the first step and walk around the block and then run around the block and then walk a mile and then run a mile, to go to the gym for the first time, to figure out how to kind of get their life going in fitness. And I think it's sort of similar with the Sunday supper, right? Like, you can't have – a habit requires starting. Mm-hmm. You can't – you know, the ritual requires beginning. And I understand that we're harried. I have an extremely harried life. But I seek pleasure in this meal. And having done it, I can do it again. There are some moments in this book when I caution – like how to modulate cooking these meals, because you don't want to burn out on doing them. Because if you stop doing them, eventually someone's going to say to you, remember when we used to have those meals? And that sentence is going to make you really sad, as it does me to hear. So I get it. We have tough lives. We have difficult lives. Everybody's working. The kids have practice. I don't even really like my neighbors all that much. But somehow we're going to start this thing. And once we start it, we can do it again and again and again. And then it's a habit and a ritual and something we look forward to.
Adrian has a very simple question. How do you safely keep plates warm?
Well, I can't imagine what the unsafe – oh, the unsafe way would be
to – be too hot where you can't hold
them. To have them too hot, yeah. I try and keep them in proximity to the stove somehow. Some people have a rack above their stove, or you can kind of put it in the center of the stove where there isn't a burner and the oven is on. You turn it a couple times and it warms up. There are dishwashers, you'd be surprised, even kind of basic dishwashers sometimes have a plate warmer function. And occasionally in a jam, when it's really, really frigid in the house and I don't have anything available to me to warm them, I'll just run hot water over the stack of them for a while and then towel them off and deliver them as if I had just like they're coming out of the barbershop freshly shaved.
Tell us about first night pasta, then we'll get back to some of our callers here.
So first night pasta is a tradition of my family's that I hope will become one of yours. And it holds that whenever we travel somewhere as a group, and we travel a lot with in-laws and with cousins and uncles and aunts, and we're going to visit someone, and we arrive in a tumble of gear and bags, or we arrive at some Airbnb together, or we go to the in-laws' house and invade, that the first meal that we're going to cook together is going to be essentially like red sauce. We use sausage, but you could use ground beef. You could use impossible ground beef, or you could have no meat in it at all. But like a big vat of red sauce over pasta with garlic bread. And this to us signals we made it. We arrived. We're here. Here's this big carb-heavy vat of deliciousness that's going to allow us to wake up tomorrow rested and ready for the day to come with family.
I mean, pasta is the greatest comfort food ever, isn't it?
It is, yes. And then just showering Parmesan onto it when it's at the table. Oh, delicious.
And you can use that trough that Marge was talking about.
That's right. It would be excellent for a family trough.
Let me get Sarah from, looks like Northern Liberties, to join our conversation. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. No problem.
I wanted to ask, how do you deal with dietary restrictions, both real and imagined, especially if you have people who you don't know showing up at your house?
Real and imagined. Well, I like that. Go ahead.
Real and imagined is true. I mean, you send your kid off to college and then they come home and they're vegan. And where did that go? Oh, my goodness. So here's how I work it. I know who is probably going to be there, and I know what their dietary restrictions are over, because remember, not a dinner party, this is a standing event. So if Jimmy from down the block, who's gluten-free, is coming, and he always comes, then we're going to probably steer clear of gluten, or we're going to have a swap out for him in some way. First night pasta, he can't partake, but oh, look, I have this chickpea pasta that I can make a half a box of for him this time because I love him. I love the kid. I want him to come. When it starts, when you as the host or as the cook start to feel like maybe you're running a restaurant or a short order situation where this person doesn't eat this and this person doesn't eat that, try and find that middle line. Mm. And then walk it for a little while and see how it feels. When I was working, cooking those dinners in the church, there were a lot of vegetarians who kind of came in. And it seemed clear that there at first had to be a vegetarian option. And then I thought, why is there a vegetarian option? Why aren't we just making vegetarian food that's delicious? It's one night a week. We can do that. And in embracing that fully, I develop new recipes that would become part of my arsenal. There's nothing wrong with adapting to the dietary restrictions of a crowd or of a part of the crowd, especially if you don't get your back up about it.
Do you have people, regulars that have come to these ritual meals for years now, decades?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are people who, there's Uncle B who is not, who's not an uncle. There's their stepmother, Brendan, who's not their stepmother. These are people who are, part of our intentional family, and who will always be part of our intentional family, and they're always welcome at our table.
Let me see what Steve from Reading has to say. And Steve, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Thanks for this program. It's really great. I wanted to be a chef when I was a kid, but I went a different direction. So I maintained my amateur standing and do all the cooking in my family, and I love to do it. And when my wife and I first got married, we were both full-time graduate students, and we had no money. So we had people over all the time and cooked together and have done that every place we've lived. And these are the closest friendships we have because we do it together.
Yeah.
Perfect.
And it's not the gourmet thing, but my wife sets these incredible themed tables, and we cook the food. And
it's just that sounds great.
You know, for me, it's a spiritual exercise, and it's out of love.
You could have written Sam
That's
Sifton's
perfect.
Book, Steve. Yeah, go
That's
ahead.
That's it. That's exactly what we're looking for. Steve mentioned, it's not the gourmet thing. Of course not. We don't want the gourmet thing. We want to have delicious food prepared with intention and love to lift the spirits of those around us and to make ourselves feel better along the way.
Steve, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Sam, you were a food critic for a couple of years for the New York Times. Once a food critic, always a food critic?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I worked as a restaurant critic at my first newspaper. I did it for the 25 and under column for the Times for a while, and then I rose to that first chair of chief restaurant critic. And, it's a tough, tough job. I realize it's hard to complain about it, but I can try. And what I would say is, you go out to fancy dinner six nights a week and hit those restaurants for lunch as well. It's grueling. It's really grueling. But it's also a tremendous gift to be able to see the kind of culture of the city through its restaurants. And what it does for me, or what it has done for me, is underscore this notion that for all my talk of just throw a bunch of stuff in a pot and serve it to your friends and family and everything will be all right. Food is a cultural product, and mm-hmm. it tells us something about where we're at and where we're going. And I think that looking at it critically and looking at its preparation critically is an important thing. It's an important thing to help communicate to our readers and listeners what matters and what matters on the plate, and what is on the plate tells us who we are.
Did you have disguises? Were you one of those food critics, as one here in Philly, that likes to make sure that they're anonymous?
Yeah, we work as hard as possible to maintain our anonymity in a digital age. When I was doing the job, I think there was one photograph of me that circulated. And I didn't employ wigs. I'm a balding guy. Like the wigs thing. You're sitting down. The waitress can waiter can look right at your terrible wig. So I wasn't going to wear a wig, but I did employ some misdirection, lots of false names and strange clothes that don't comport to what everybody said. You know, Sam Sifton's a preppy guy from New York, wears blue blazers, et cetera. I wouldn't do that, and therefore I was just a guy who maybe looked like Sam Sifton but wasn't. We try hard. We try hard. Fake names. It's like being Jason Bourne with no danger whatsoever.
And did you have a microphone up your sleeve that you could talk into to take notes?
You know, it's interesting. The note-taking in the old days at my first paper was difficult. You know, I would run off to the bathroom three, four, five times a meal to scribble notes in a stall, like I had some kind of infection. But lately, because everyone has a phone and everyone's obsessed with food and everyone is posting pictures of their food to Instagram, I can just take pictures, take notes. I'm texting the sitter. This mm-hmm. lamb is terrible. And keep notes right there at the table. It's really there are a few upsides to our digital age, and one of them is it's easier to be a restaurant critic.
Sarah has a comment. My kids are in the habit of setting the table, sitting with their parents, and experiencing the dinner as a reprieve to the chaos of our lives. Even if we don't have a remarkable conversation, we have grown to appreciate and relish the family time.
I love that.
I think people are on to what you're writing here, Sam. Let me get Patty from Wilmington to join us. And Patty, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Hi there, Patty.
Hi there. Great program today.
Thank you.
I'm a professor of communication, and I love the idea that you're talking about messages and how meals are messages. I grew up in a family that went to my grandmother's house every Sunday. My mother carried on that tradition, so I ate dinner with almost 30 people every week. And now my brother tries to do it almost every Sunday, but there's always an extra plate for whoever can make it.
Oh,
so
nice.
It's really important that we understand the quality of the message at the meal, too, because that's how kids learn to interact with older adults and how they model the behaviors and the values that we want at the dinner table.
You nailed
A+.
It, Patty. You get an A+ from Sam Sifton. Patty, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We're almost out of time, Sam, but I'm just curious. Do you watch cooking shows and cooking competitions, Gordon Ramsay, people like that?
You know, it's interesting. My kids were into TV food competitions for years. I felt like, it was like Busman's Holiday or something. Like, really? I got to watch these guys compete? This is what I'm thinking about at work all the time. But the truth is, I kind of find it soothing, and I do enjoy it. If you're going to watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives with Guy Fieri, like,
yeah.
I love him. Love that guy. I'd like him to come to my Sunday supper.
Well, I hope you have a wonderful Sunday supper. It's got me thinking about my Sunday supper. So thank you so much.
I hope lots of people are thinking about it, and I hope they all join their friends and family at the table. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Sam Sifton's new cookbook is called See You on Sunday. He's the food editor of the New York Times, a columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He's also founding editor of New York Times Cooking. He was formerly the chief restaurant critic also at the New York Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Charlie Kyer, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with one more piece of music. This is Nat King Cole's Trio, 1945, Frim Fram Sauce.
I don't want French fried potatoes, red ripe tomatoes. I'm never satisfied. I want the frim fram sauce with the awesome fee, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim fram sauce with the awesome fee, with shafafa on the side. a fella really got to eat.